Hi, welcome to the Professionals Playbook. I'm Justin Lee, an F-35 fighter pilot for the U.S. Air Force. My guest today is Gunner Jeanette, a professional race car driver who competes in the IMSA Championship. He is the youngest driver to ever finish the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Before we get to a highlight, if you're enjoying the show, you can help by writing a review on iTunes, subscribing to the show, and sharing it on social media. If you want to write in, my email is justin@professionalsplaybook.com or DM me at @JustinFighterPilot on Facebook or Instagram. All right, here's a brief highlight from our conversation today.
Most of the time when we're driving, we'll be in the car from an hour to max 4 hours at a time. and Le Mans is very different because the track is so long and there are so many straightaways. We have four straightaways on that circuit that are about a mile long. So ordinarily, some of the shorter tracks, you kind of don't have time for your mind to really wander because, you know, you're so focused and you're essentially constantly busy. A straightaway that's a mile long, even though, you know, we're going 180 to 200 miles an hour, depending on the type of car you're in, you know, it's still, once you get on the straightaway, that's kind of when your work ends. So it's kind of time to, you know, make sure that everything's good, temperatures, pressures, all that kind of stuff.
Gunner started racing at the age of 16 and made the jump to the professional ranks less than a year later. At 18, he became the youngest driver to ever finish the 24 Hours of Le Mans. He has since raced there an additional 7 times. He has also competed in the American Le Mans Series, the Rolex Sports Car Series, and the World Endurance Championship. His titles include the 2005 Grand Am Team Cup Champion, the 2011 ALMS LMPC Driver Championship, and the 2013 ELMS GTE Team Champion. In addition to being a professional race car driver, Gunner is an avid skydiver. He has thousands of jumps and hundreds of base jumps. Gunner has also participated in several world record skydives and has been featured on MTV, People Magazine, USA Today, and now this podcast. So without further ado, Gunner Jeanette.
I saw that you have competed at Le Mans 7 times, including being the youngest driver ever to finish. Can you describe what the race is and what it's like to be competing on the world stage like that?
Yeah, so the 24 Hours of Le Mans is the largest sports car race in existence. If you talk to kind of any real racing driver, it's one of the top 3 or 4 races in the world. You know, Monaco Grand Prix, Indy 500, to some Daytona 500, and the 24 Hours of Le Mans. So the race has been going on since the very early 1900s. You know, initially it was a test and a showpiece for car and auto manufacturers that, you know, their cars could even just do that. and it has since, you know, become the iconic race in sports car racing, and it's still, you know, the race that anybody in sports car racing wants to win. And, you know, for anybody that knows anything about Steve McQueen, you know, that was sort of the greatest thing that he wanted to show, and you know, the history of Steve McQueen. I mean, he basically almost bankrupted himself creating the movie Le Mans. and if you're into cars at all, I highly recommend it because it is probably the most true, you know, movie about auto racing, and the cinematography of it is totally incredible. So yeah, I've been fortunate enough to race there 7 or 8 times. Well, actually more than that, cause I've done some historic races there too. But yeah, so at, the first time I went there, I was 17, and they always have a Le Mans test day, which is ordinarily a month to a couple weeks before the race. And, one of the things about Le Mans is that over, I think about 60% of it is actually on public roads. So the track doesn't exist in its full form you know, like a lot of other racetracks do, where you can go and test there pretty much whenever you want. You know, they close down the roads for the race, and then they actually, on the practice days and stuff, they'll open the roads back up for all the normal traffic, and then, you know, they close it and you get to go out and practice. So so for me, as a kid who grew up around sports car racing, to get to be there, you know, at 17, and then, you know, I did the race when I was barely 18, is absolutely, you know, one of the most memorable things that I've ever done in my life, and I'll definitely take those memories with me to the grave.
What's it like being an 18-year-old, being on the world stage like that?
It was super cool, super intimidating. So we went and it's three drivers, and you basically, you know, you try to make the car run for 24 hours nonstop. So when the car comes in for fuel and tires, that's when you do a driver change. And so splitting that up with just two other guys, it's a pretty grueling event. And when I went there for the first year, even though I was so young, I was actually the fastest guy in the car. And so because of that, I was the one that, you know, got to do the qualifying, and then I got to actually start the race too. And, there's a famous scene in the Steve McQueen movie, Le Mans, where the start, and, you know, it's super artsy and it's just got a heartbeat thing kind of going on. And, you know, I'm sitting there on the grid waiting for this race to start, and my heart, you know, is beating just like that scene. It felt like it was about to rip out of my chest. But, and then that year in that start, there was a car that caught fire. The Cadillac factory car caught fire in like the first 10 minutes. And so immediately we're full course yellow. We're going slow, and a lap there is 8.5 miles long. So you're going around the track at only about 60 miles an hour. And only then did it really sink in what I was doing, because when you're going fast, you know, 100% of your mental capacity is, you know, doing what you're doing, keeping the car on the road, trying to go as fast as you go, as you can, and racing against other guys. But then under yellow, you know, you can just sort of chill out. And to look at the surroundings and see how many people were there, you know, that was the real moment where it kind of sunk in what I was getting to be a part of. I mean, National Geographic, I think a couple of years ago, rated it as the number one sporting event in the world to attend. And, you know, on any given year, there's around 300,000 to 400,000 people that go. I mean, people in America don't really realize what it is unless you're, you know, a hardcore sort of car person. But in Europe and across, you know, basically the entire world, you know, people make the trek out there. And in Europe, all the car clubs will drive, you know, whether it's Porsches or Ferraris or Audis or, you know, small little British manufacturers, and they'll get groups of them together and drive there and just camp. And, you know, some of the guys just are in an alcoholic haze for 4 days straight. So it's really amazing. And I consider myself hugely fortunate to have gotten to a race there so many times, and I've had some pretty good results there. I haven't won it, unfortunately. But I've got to stand on the podium twice, and standing on the podium, they sort of they don't let the crowds, but the crowds will climb over the fence and stuff and kind of rush the podium. And if there's ever been a feeling of being like a dictator, that's it, because you're standing on this, you know, raised platform with just, you know, this sea of tens of thousands of people, you know, underneath you, cheering you. It's extremely memorable.
So you mentioned being intimidated when you're 18 years old, starting the race. Has your feeling towards the race over the years changed?
Yes and no. I mean, now it's, when I do get to go, cause it's not really an every year thing. It just sort of depends. Cause I mean, in the world of sports car racing, you have, you know, series from
all over the globe. So here in the US, that's IMSA and the WeatherTech Championship. But then you have European Le Mans Series, you've got an Asian Le Mans Series. You know, there's stuff that runs all over the place, and you know, the pinnacle of all of that are people trying to get there. And they only start, it used to be like 48 cars, and they've raised that up into the 50s now. So just to get an entry into that race is really special. But yeah, I mean, it's still by far the most challenging race on the calendar, just because, you know, there's so many things that can go against you. The weather is always a super big variable there. So I've definitely learned a lot more about it, and I am, you know, way more comfortable going there when I do. But yeah, I mean, you never know what's going to get thrown at you there.
So as an experienced driver now, looking at that 18-year-old kid, what would you say his strengths are? And then how do you think you've evolved over the years as a driver?
I mean, I can't count many strengths other than just being really lucky to get to be in the right place in the right time for that. I like to think that I definitely never try to stop learning, you know, no matter how long I've been doing this. And I've been racing cars professionally now for almost 20 years. There's not a season goes by or I mean, even a race that you go to where you don't, you know, sort of learn something one way or another. And that's just, you know, experience that you try to bring into the next thing. And Le Mans in particular is a track where experience really counts for a lot. Because I mean, there's certain situations, the track is so big that a lot of times it'll be raining in one part of the track and totally dry on the other part of the track. So trying to make tire calls and stuff like that can be, you know, extremely difficult. And because part of the track are public roads, I mean, even that just, it can vary so much. And I mean, even from the start of the race to the finish, the track changes a huge amount, because obviously the rubber going down, it makes everything, you know, go better, in the middle of the night when the temperature drops. You know, you gain a huge amount of performance. And now, you know, when the cars are way more focused on aerodynamics, you know, temperature changes, and, you know, humidity changes can alter the car's balance a huge amount. So if you have the car, you know, totally tuned and balanced to being, you know, really good in the heat of the day, as it cools off at night, I mean, the car could, you know, go a direction that you don't want it to go. So a lot of it is trying to figure out where your strengths and weaknesses are going to be, and then, you know, try to pick the point where you want to be the fastest. And a lot of it, honestly, is just about survival. And so many guys now that especially come from like the single seater backgrounds, you know, just want to be as fast as you can all the time. And that's definitely the case, but you just don't want to take any unnecessary risk, because all it takes is one small thing to happen and, you know, your chances of winning are over. And you know, as a budget on the lowest class of car to run there is, you know, close to $1 million. So it's like, you know, one silly little mistake and wrong thought and, you know, boom, everything goes out the window.
How do you stay mentally engaged for that long of a time? I know when I was in Afghanistan, we were flying between 5 and 8 hour missions, and it was a big challenge in a single seat plane to stay mentally engaged, you know, of a high performance aircraft. What are some of the things that you do to stay focused?
Yeah, I mean, the driving thing, I've been sort of a student of the, not to sound too cliche, but a student of the mind. And most of the driving stuff, when you're driving at your best, you're basically driving at a pure subconscious level. And you know, there's plenty of terms with it, with athletic performance stuff, being in the zone, that type of thing. Most of the time when we're driving, we'll be in the car from an hour to max 4 hours at a time. And Le Mans is very different because the track is so long and there are so many straightaways. We have four straightaways on that circuit that are about a mile long. So ordinarily, some of the shorter tracks, you kind of don't have time for your mind to really wander. Because you know, you're so focused and you're essentially constantly busy. A straightaway that's a mile long, even though, you know, we're going 180 to 200 miles an hour, depending on the type of car you're in. You know, it's still, once you get on the straightaway, that's kind of when your work ends. So it's kind of time to, you know, make sure that everything's good, you know, temperatures, pressures, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, you can, you know, wander a little bit, and especially, you know, in the most of the time when a lot of mental lapses happen are, you know, you're tired, you've been in the car for a couple hours, it's night, the sun hasn't quite come up yet. and I mean, all it takes is missing a braking point by 50 feet. And now you've put yourself where you're just basically trying to survive and not destroy the car. So, but like anything else, you kind of just get into a rhythm and you just want to make sure that you have all of your reference points and are paying attention to your reference points. So that's sort of the biggest thing. And it's really tough because, you know, you start and you feel great. And then, you know, when we're in the car and we're driving, most of us are sort of in aerobic threshold kind of heart rate stuff for pretty much the whole time that we're driving. And so, you know, you do that for 3 hours, and by the time you get out, you're pretty tired and have a huge caloric deficit. And so ordinarily, like, you get out of the car, you have a debrief with your engineers, and then you immediately go and just try to get as many sort of calories in as you can. And, you know, that's basically going to be some sort of a pasta and chicken or eggs or whatever to pound some carbohydrates and protein. And then try to maybe go see your physio. Most teams have physiotherapists now, so it's some mixture of massage, chiropractic type of stuff. And then when you're done with all that stuff, now you've been out of the car for an hour, hour and a half, somewhere in there. And then, you know, you try to fall asleep. But most of the time it's like, if you're lucky, you'll get half an hour to an hour of sleep before, you know, you're basically up and back in the pits and getting ready for your next stint. So after doing that a couple of times, you know, the last couple of stints, you're normally pretty worn out. You probably have blisters on your hands, you know, pretty much every part of you is hurting one way or another. And yeah, so it's definitely a big challenge and a huge undertaking. And again, part of why experience there really does count for a lot.
Do you see a big variance in drivers? Some are skilled for shorter races and some are skilled for these longer endurance races, or is it just something that drivers learn?
No, it's definitely, so it used to be that, you know, the single series or single seater sort of stuff. So Formula One, IndyCar, you know, those types of racing guys back, I mean, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, there was really good big money in that stuff. So guys could make it to, you know, Champ Car or IndyCar here in the US, and they were making, you know, multiples of millions of dollars a year. And a lot of that sort of went away. And so a lot of guys are bringing sponsorship, bringing money to those types of things. And so now it's shifted a little bit to where guys are looking at sports car racing coming out of single seater series earlier in their careers. And a lot of those sort of feeder series in the open wheel stuff, you know, the races are 30 minutes, 45 minutes long, that type of thing. So throughout my career, I've been paired with, you know, these sort of open wheel guys that come through various stuff. And it's been sort of comical in some regard because some of them are really, really fast, but they're really, really fast for like a couple of laps, and then, you know, their physical fitness or whatever just isn't really sort of up to snuff. And then, you know, you're yanking them out of the car, especially in hot situations. You know, you're yanking them out of the car before the stint's actually over and their eyes are rolling in the back of their head and, you know, they're making mistakes and that type of stuff. So endurance racing still is, you know, there is definitely an aspect of endurance to that. You know, cars are getting a lot easier to drive now, and I really hate it because the majority of the cars we drive now have ABS and traction control, and a lot of them have air conditioning. It's like, you know, when I started, you had to shift the car manually. There was none of the paddle shifting stuff. There was no ABS. There was no traction control. And, you know, you were racing in the middle of the summertime, and some cars would get to be, you know, 130 degrees inside of the cockpit. And then you're wearing, you know, three layers of Nomex and a helmet and all that kind of stuff. So the right training did count for a lot. And now, you know, that's kind of fallen away a little bit. And for me, growing up around, you know, older cars and, you know, historic racing and that type of stuff, cars had a lot more character back then. You know, it wasn't, everything was designed by a computer. But that's a different discussion.
And so the driver had to make up for different flaws in the car.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, again, with the endurance racing stuff, you know, if you were tired and you missed a shift and over rev the motor, then, you know, race over. Now with paddle shift, you know, that totally takes that sort of aspect out of the equation. And with a paddle shifter, you've got in all of these safeties built into the, basically into the ECU. And so you're never going to miss a shift. And that kind of, for me, takes away some of the, you know, purism of endurance racing.
So you mentioned the importance of physical fitness. And I think what I've heard, driving is a little bit similar to flying a fighter, in that a lot of people think that we just sit in a seat, but when you're under right. extreme G forces, you really have to make sure that your body is in good shape, not only to not pass out, but also so that you have a long career and you don't damage your neck or your spine. Can you talk a little bit about your fitness routine?
Yeah. So, I mean, like you said, it is similar. It is a fair bit different in the fact of what you guys are dealing with, is majority of vertical G's. And most of what we're dealing with is either lateral or longitudinal G's. So instead of getting compressed, you know, we're getting thrown side to side or forward. But a similar type of thing. I mean, in the sort of top level of sports car stuff, you know, you can be driving a car that'll do, you know, 4 G's under braking, not quite to Formula One level stuff, but it's still pretty high. And so, you know, depending on the type of car you're driving will sort of dictate your physical fitness. So like in a GT car will probably develop on the high side a little over 2 G's in cornering and in braking. But the inside cockpit temperature will also be, you know, normally get pretty high in the summertime. We had a race at Watkins Glen up in upstate New York this year. And the cockpit temperature was about 125 degrees, and you're trying to do a double stint in there for 2 hours. So that is a lot more aerobic fitness, just making sure that, you know, you can sort of deal with that. Whereas when you're driving the prototype cars, that will do, you know, sort of around 3 to 4 G's cornering and braking. But a lot of those will be open cockpit. Just having the open cockpit, you know, the air going over your head and the ability to crack your visor and get some cool air in there is a little bit less of a aerobic requirement. But then, you know, as far as the G forces go, especially your neck, neck is a big one. You know, if you're not training for a while, that's sort of the first thing that you really feel when you're starting to feel like you're a bobblehead doll and you don't really have control of where your head's going. and so for me personally, I really like cycling. And so I've gotten into cycling sort of in the last 10 years. And yeah, I mean, not as much as I would like to, but I normally sort of ride around 3,000 or 4,000 miles a year. And I actually do some local crit racing just because it's sort of fun. Not too much mountain biking because my skill set on two wheels isn't as good as on four. And my enthusiasm normally outweighs my skill set. but yeah. And then I actually have a go-kart. And it's not just like the normal run of the mill 5 horsepower sort of go-kart that you get at any normal concession place. It's a 125 cc shifter cart. That's basically a 125 cc dirt bike engine with 6 gears. And that it'll go about 110 miles an hour and it'll pull 3 G's basically with no suspension. So you go out and, you know, you pound around in that for a while. And that, in all honesty, is the absolute best training for racing. And it's a heck of a lot of fun too.
Geez, 3 and 4 G's is I remember in high school, I got a ride in a 2004 Corvette Z06, and that thing corners at like 1 G, and yeah, it was mind blowing for me at the time. So I can't imagine what 3 and 4 G's on a road feels like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always fun getting to give rides to people. And, you know, some of the cars that we'll drive, we'll put a second seat in for promotional purposes and stuff. And just, you know, everybody's perception of what is possible is so far below what we can actually do that, you know, going into the first braking zone, if it's a long straightaway and you're going 150 plus, it's fun just to watch the people start squirming. And you're like, oh yeah, we got a little ways to go before we're going to hit the brakes. you hit their brakes and they go so far into the harness that their head almost hits the dashboard.
Yeah, flying's the same way. Unfortunately, we don't have a back seat mostly fortunately, but there's only single seat F-35s. In the F-16, I had the privilege to give probably about a dozen people rides, and just about every single one threw up. It's just so much force on the body, and it's really hard on the body, and most of them just slept for the rest of the day. So I think most people don't realize like how stressful these machines are on the human body.
Yeah. I actually got to, a promotion with the series years ago. Klein Tools was a sponsor, and they had a Klein Tools stunt plane that was, extra 300 with 2 seats. And so I did enough promotional stuff that I got to go flying with them. And I said, you know, hey, look, I really like this type of stuff, but I have no idea how I'm going to be. So just like start slow and just keep on ramping it up until, you know, I cry uncle or feel like I'm going to puke. And it was awesome. We pulled 9 G's in a quick pullout. And then we did a big, long 6 G sort of sustained turn. And you know, it was like my vision was going, and then it was totally gray, and I was like blinking my eyes and I couldn't see anything. And we came out of the turn and I was like, wow, that was crazy. I couldn't see anything, but I'm pretty sure my eyes were open. Why did we stop? And the pilot was like, oh, I couldn't see anything either. So I figured we should probably come out of it. It's like, oh, okay.
Yep. Hopefully he was doing a good AGSM. So we call it anti-G straining maneuver. That's a big thing for us, since we deal with so many Gs. And, you know, unfortunately in the F-16, we lost about one pilot a year to a G lock because you lose consciousness for about 30 seconds. And if the speeds were flying, you'll impact the ground in about 10, 15 seconds. So there's a huge emphasis on handling the Gs, making sure you're squeezing your calves, your thighs, your butt, your abs, and then also making sure that your body is ready to go. So making sure that you're get a good night's sleep, that you eat, even being 2% dehydrated can reduce your G tolerance by 20%. So it's really important.
That's amazing.
Whole thing good to go, because the machine is pretty much at the human limit.
Right. Yeah. And probably even past what humans can deal with.
Yeah. Well, definitely what the weakest point is. I would say probably most pilots could pull a little bit more if they're, you know, at the 100% level. But once, you know, they didn't sleep well, they might have some stress at home, they didn't eat, they're maybe not doing the best AGSM. It just takes one time, you know, dipping below that 9G threshold that can put you out. So it's really important for us to take care of our bodies, as I'm sure being a driver.
Yeah.
So what else is the training like? So I know as a race car driver, you have seasons. So when you're in the off season, do you have commitments and things to do? Are you training your body? Are you training in the car? Or is it more some free time to go ahead and relax mentally and physically from driving?
It's definitely a combination. And it really sort of depends on the year and the program. Really every time that we have the car out. So if we went and did a 2-day test at, you know, somewhere like in Sebring, Florida or something, that test is probably going to cost us around $60,000 to $100,000. So, you know, budget wise, it's not a drop in the bucket. Because of that, the series actually will mandate how many test days we're allowed. So we want to make sure that those count. So, and in previous years and in, you know, different classes of racing, that's more open. And so, you know, people will go and they'll test a lot. For me, that's when I get a lot of my sort of base fitness in is the off season stuff. Because once you're in the middle of the season, it's hard to keep up the same routine when you're, you know, constantly traveling to different locations and all of that. So it's like having a real good, you know, aerobic and strength base in the beginning of the year is great, because inevitably as the season goes on, you're going to lose that type of fitness, but you're trading that for more driving specific fitness, because you're just going to be driving more. And it's funny, because there's really nothing that really replicates driving perfectly except for just getting out there and doing it. So the first couple races of the year, you'll get out of the car after a stint and go, oh man, wow, that, you know, my butt is really sore, or this or that. And then a couple races into it, you know, the strength just sort of happens naturally. And then, you know, you're fine right in that peak season. I mean, in the middle of the year, I think July and August, we'll have like, I think 1 month, we have like 3 races in a month. So you're just, you know, always in the car. But another thing, I mean, I do a lot of stuff on a simulator, and that's something where, it's really gotten to a good point in sort of the last 4 or 5 years. It used to be that simulation stuff was more so just video games. And so, you know, you could get a video game and kind of learn a track that you'd never been to before. Just so you at least know, hey, I'm going here. And I know that, you know, turn three is a right-hander and turn four is a left and there's a chicane coming up and then a heavy braking zone and that type of stuff. But now, I mean, even sort of the home simulator type of stuff is good enough that you can do a bunch of laps and you know, when you get to that track, you're going to reduce that amount of sort of, you know, learning time there and that really just goes into, you know, the overall cost and how quickly you get up to speed. And if you're comfortable in the car, then, you know, you can get to actually doing setup work a lot faster. Because, you know, the setup of the car is so important with what we're doing. So the GT Daytona class that I've been racing in, I mean, the whole field of, you know, 15 to over 20 cars can be separated by 1 second of a lap, which is it's so small. So you're fighting for tenths and even thousands of seconds. So if in the first practice session you can come out of the box and you're boom immediately up to speed and can really start working on the car faster, then, you know, you've got a better chance come race time. And then now simulation and the car modeling has become so good that the engineers are using them. They'll create a model of the car, you know, with a horsepower profile, and then with the chassis simulation stuff, and, you know, the aerodynamic profiles and all that they can actually run through, you know, different spring and bar combinations, different aero packages and all that stuff. And so the engineers will come to the track with, okay, this is where we should be with our spring rates. And then we're going to, you know, try option B, and then we're going to try option C. And then what they can do is they can overlay that, the data that we actually get from the car on track with the simulation stuff, see where it correlates and where it's maybe a little bit different. And then for the next day, you know, basically make changes based upon that. And so that is really an invaluable tool. You know, when you're talking about a single test day at the track, you know, maybe being upwards of $50,000.
So are you using, when you're at home, a special simulator, or is it, you know, like a PlayStation 4 or Xbox?
No. So there's a thing called iRacing that came out, gosh, it's probably almost 10 years old now. But they definitely have the best sort of what I would call a consumer program right now. And I mean, the guys go out and they, you know, do laser scans of the racetracks and all that kind of stuff. So, a lot of the nuances that would be missed on actual, you know, video games are pretty accurate in that. And, you know, some tracks are better than others. None of them are going to be, you know, 100%. But it's pretty good. And so I have, the sim rig that I've pieced together sort of over the years, and it probably cost me, I don't know, $6,000-$7,000, something like that. With a good set of hydraulic pedals, a beefy electronic or a direct drive electric motor steering wheel. And then, you know, that's something that I can use day to day here. There are the companies that do the big actual simulation models. They will build, like, Formula One teams each have their own simulator, and the model that they use for the car is literally the simulation model that all the engineers are using. So that's called a driver in the loop simulator, and those things cost about $1 million. But then, you know, they're on, it's essentially, you know, like a flight simulator on a hexapod, with, you know, some of them have 180 degree wraparound screens. So yeah, the amount of money that you can spend on that stuff is pretty big, but, now even the consumer level is pretty decent where you can actually use it.
So what would you say the percentage wise between training in a simulator versus training, actually on the road?
In all reality, from like what I have here, I'll use the simulator just to sort of knock some rust off before going to the track, and I'll drive different cars and change the setup around and you know, drive a car that understeers bad and drive a car that oversteers bad to sort of just get used to certain things. But in terms of, you know, I'm never going to go to a racetrack and be like, oh yeah, well, on the simulator, you know, I ran the springs 100 pounds stiffer than we're running now, so I think we should do that. For me, it's just about, you know, sort of getting up to speed before the work kind of begins once you get to the racetrack.
That makes sense. We utilize simulators quite a bit here. They definitely have their limitations, but I'd say the strength is we can, first of all, practice some basic maneuvers without having to waste all the money of actually flying a sortie,
yep.
But also it allows us to kind of push the envelope and do things that we might do in combat, but that don't make sense to do in a training day.
Yeah, well, I'm sure for you guys too, systems wise, it's really nice because it's, you know, basically pretty close to identical with what you deal with on a day-to-day basis too.
It's pretty good, but I mean, simulators still have their limitations. And I think even if they made a simulator perfect, we have a saying that as soon as you put the helmet on, your IQ drops 20 points.
Yeah.
So once you're, you know, putting on, or, you know, you're putting on all this gear, you're going out to the jet, it's hot, you're sweating, you know, you have some minor things going on with the jet that you have to fix with the avionics. By the time you finally roll out, you can be spent. So what does a race day for you look like? So your alarm goes off. What are you doing after that?
When I'm good, I'll try to do some stretches or a little bit of yoga in the hotel room. just, you know, sort of, and I'm kind of big for a racing driver. I'm about 6 feet tall. A lot of these guys are like jockeys. So depending on the car, sometimes I can be pretty comfortable and other times it's a pretty uncomfortable position to be in for a while. But yeah, then normally, you know, go to the track. We have, normally some pretty good catering services and so, you know, get some breakfast and coffee at the track. Most race days we'll have a warm up, that's about 20 minutes long. You hope that you're not trying to actually get any work done in the warm up, because if you are, that means the beginning of the weekend hasn't gone very well. sometimes we'll actually try to skip warm up because a lot of things can go bad in warm up, and not a lot of good things normally come out of it. There's been a lot of teams that have totally, you know, destroyed the car in warm up and then don't make the race. So you never really want to have the mentality of trying to go win the warm up. But yeah, then, sort of after that, you know, probably have a small engineering, and sort of strategy meeting, with your other drivers, engineers, team owner, that type of thing. And then, I will normally try to get a nap in. I always just like to try to, you know, put my headphones on and just sort of chill out as much as possible. There's, when the car goes to the grid, you sort of drive it from the pit sort of as slow as you can to save fuel, because you'll fill the car completely. And then, you know, on hilly tracks, I'll actually be like putting the clutch in and coasting downhill and stuff. And then you park it on the grid, and then sort of all the pomp and circumstance happens. in IMSA, they actually open the grid up to the fans. It's one of the great things about sports car racing is our interaction with the fans. And so people get to come out and, you know, see the cars up close, take pictures, all that type of stuff. Meanwhile, you know, all the, you know, promotional girls are running around, the anthems are going off. And that normally is about like an hour, hour and a half long. And, especially in the middle of the summertime, you know, you're out there in the heat and just trying to sort of escape the sun. And so ordinarily, like I'll just go and escape and hang out in the AC in our trailer and just kind of zone out. And like, if I can get a half an hour nap in, I'm super happy. and then, yeah, back in the car, you know, start engines, get to the pace lap and then, you know, just hope for a good race start and not too much chaos from that point.
And then are you guys after the race doing a like thorough debrief? I know as a fighter pilot, we spend about three times the time we spent flying in the debrief, just kind of going over every error that we made.
Yeah, we definitely do some of that. It's not that introspective immediately after the fact, because we get so much data. Ordinarily, that will sort of come over the next couple of days, because you know immediately after the race, you know the car will get impounded. And you know, if you do well, it goes to tech. So, you know, there's some sort of a technical inspection going on. Sometimes it can be quick. Sometimes, you know, they're really tearing into stuff to make sure that you're legal. And so, you know, from that point on, ordinarily you can't even touch the car for, you know, the next couple hours after the race. And at the same time, you know, the team shows up in these semi trailers and creates this big sort of, you know, area workspace and, you know, all of that for the team and sponsors and guests and all that. So all the crew guys are just trying to tear that down and get it loaded up into the trailer as quickly as possible. So we'll normally have, a short kind of debrief after the race, but then, you know, once all the data comes in, both from onboard the car and then in the timing and scoring system, we get a huge amount of data from that and from the series of you know, sector times, pit stop times, you know, pit in to pit out, you know, just all sorts of this stuff that takes a little while. And most people will have, you know, sort of Excel spreadsheet programs that you can import that into, and then you'll get like this generated report that's, you know, 5 to 35 pages long sort of thing. And so normally it's like the couple of days after the race that you're really digging into that. And the cool thing is that there's so many manufacturers in the class, you know, you can see, okay, well, this car was fast in, you know, the high speed sectors. This car was fast in the speed trap. This car was fast in the low speed kind of areas. And so you really sort of dig into it then. And then, you know, from a driving standpoint, ordinarily, you know, either on the flight home or a couple days after when it's kind of all sunken in, you know, I'll generate a report about, you know, where I thought we were strong or weak and, you know, sort of how the race went and how I feel like we can improve. And so ordinarily it just kind of turns into a big email chain from that point.
And is there kind of like a senior driver or somebody in charge that's running the debrief and kind of critiquing, you know, things that you could have done better? Or is that mostly you doing that?
No. So it just depends on the team and the year. Like, you know, if you go into a new team and there's been a driver that's been there for 5 years and he's kind of the lead guy, you just kind of go with what the team wants to do. And ordinarily, you know, the team engineer will kind of dictate how they want things. And so that, you know, basically I just try to be as flexible as possible and, you know, give the information in whatever way they and format that sort of works.
So having raced for the better part of 20 years, what are the top couple of things that you see makes a good driver?
Yeah. So that's something that is really interesting with this. There's definitely guys who have a huge amount of natural ability. And then there's guys maybe with less natural ability, but have a really, really good work ethic. And so it's a, with racing, it's a really interesting sort of, just seeing the different kind of profiles of people that are involved. 'Cause you have guys that are so naturally gifted and just don't give a shit about the debriefing, about car setup, about any of that kind of stuff. Just sort of, yeah, give me whatever and I'll drive it. And you have guys that are the opposite that, okay, maybe aren't that good, but they're, you know, came from an engineering background or something like that. And so they're super, super technical. I think, you know, I feel like I'm kind of somewhere in the middle of that. I've definitely had co-drivers that just have an insane amount of natural ability, and other guys that, you know, didn't, but, you know, absolutely worked their butts off to get there. So yeah, that's, something that's definitely interesting. You know, the racing industry is kind of, weird because even at the top level of motorsport, you have people who are paying to be there. You know, it's like, what other type of job would you go to? And somebody's paying $1 million a year to go do their job. And so that's, something that's kind of hard to deal with sometimes. 'Cause it's like, well, I know I'm a better driver than so-and-so, but you know, I want to get paid and they're bringing, you know, $1.5 million to the program. And, you know, at the level of budgets that this takes, you know, a lot of times the team just has to take the guy who maybe isn't a better driver, but has the budget so the team can survive.
It seems like a added wrinkle that you wouldn't expect to have to deal with.
Yeah. And it's, you know, from that standpoint, you know, it's a really tough industry. And I feel very fortunate that I actually have been able to make a living out of it for as long as I have. But yeah, I mean the off season, a lot of years is super stressful, just trying to figure out what the deal is going to be for the next year.
So I guess elaborating on the last question, is there anything that, you see out of, going from a good driver to a great driver? I think as a fighter pilot, it's being able to prioritize well. So usually on the mission, you'll have more tasks to do than what you're capable of. So right. Being able to make a decision what to drop out and then being able to handle pressure. I think those would be the two things that you know, separate a good pilot from a great pilot. Is there anything like that in driving?
I mean, to certain extents, I mean, a lot of it with driving and especially, you know, teams that do have multiple drivers is the car setup really comes into play a lot. So, you know, between two drivers, you know, one guy might like a car that, you know, has no oversteer at all. And one guy might like the car that's, you know, has a lot of oversteer and is really loose. So, the ability to adapt to the car and to get the most out of the car, sort of regardless of the car setup, I think is hugely, hugely valuable. Cause you know, I'm sure in like flying a plane, you know, every plane has a little bit different characteristics, and some of them, you know, sort of fit better than others. It's sort of the same thing, and probably a little bit more so with cars. And so you have some guys who, you know, can be absolutely magic in one type of car, and then you put them in something else and they just can't figure out how to drive it. And that's something that I've really tried to expand my tool set in, you know, the last 5-10 years, and try to get away from a specific driving style to being more adaptable to just finding the best way to make the car work. And there's so many small details with that, as far as, you know, throttle application, and especially the entry into the corners, off the braking, how you sort of release the brake pedal. And because if you think of it, you know, what we're doing as drivers with the car is, you know, what you can do with your feet is you're controlling the weight balance of the car between the front and the rear. And everything that we do as drivers are going through, what we call our contact patches, which is basically the tires. So in each tire, you know, where the tire contacts the road is only really a very small piece of rubber. And so how we manage that through our inputs, is basically, you know, how we can get the car to work through the corners. So yeah, the ability to adapt to a car is really, I think, one of the most important things, you know, especially in sports car racing when you're driving with different guys and different cars.
So not only are you a professional race car driver, which is awesome, but you are a skydiver with thousands of jumps and hundreds of base jumps. Can you talk a little bit about how you got into that?
Yeah. So I remember being a kid and watching the movie Point Break and seeing the skydiving scenes in that, and just thinking that you know, those were the coolest things that I had ever seen. And so, you know, you have to be 18 in order to skydive pretty much most places. And so my 18th birthday, I went skydiving, and it was equally amazing. It did not let me down at all. But at the same time, I was starting my racing career and didn't really have time for it. And then I kind of got to a point where, you know, I had various contracts that obviously don't want you to do silly things like skydiving. I had a contract that ended that was keeping me from doing it. And so I just thought, hey, I've got a little bit of extra time, I'm going to get into it. And just kind of went headfirst into it, so to speak. My second year, I did about 750 skydives in the year. Started base jumping. I started doing wingsuit flying stuff. And then, you know, just sort of progressed from there to, I remember I was learned a base jump here in the US at the only legal bridge, that's open, basically every day a year. And that's the Perrine Bridge up in Idaho. And I was living in Atlanta at the time, and sort of the normal way you do it is you kind of find like a base mentor who's got a bunch of experience, and then they'll, you know, take you and show you sort of objects and that type of stuff. And, talk about a sort of culture shock. you know, started going and jumping, antennas. There's this 1,000-foot antenna that, you know, you had to hop over the fence and, you know, basically climb illegally, to jump off of this 1,000-foot tower in the middle of a field somewhere. That was absolutely, totally incredible. And then we did, you know, some building jumps and some crane jumps in downtown Atlanta. And it's just like sort of this underworld thing. That's just, it was one of the coolest things that I had ever done at the time. And I was doing the 24 hours of Le Mans, and, we had kind of a little bit of time before and a little bit of time after. So I thought, hey, I'm going to be in Europe anyways. Like, I'm going to go to Switzerland and you know, jump in the Lauterbrunnen Valley, which is right by the Eiger. And that totally ruined all of American base jumping for me. Because, you know, you get basically a lift up to the top of this 2,000-foot, you know, cliff in the Alps with the most beautiful scenery ever. You're not having to worry about, you know, getting arrested or anything because it's totally legal over there. And, you know, you go up and you know, if you hit it hard, you're getting 6 to 10 jumps a day. You know, flying next to waterfalls and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, basically at that point I stopped doing, you know, any of the illegal jump sort of things. And I was racing in Europe. So I was, you know, going to Norway and Switzerland and France you know, was lucky enough to sort of be at the forefront of the wingsuit sort of base jumping stuff at the time. And, so yeah, I got into that pretty heavily. And over the years, it's kind of come and gone, lost a decent amount of friends, you know, sort of over the years through accidents and whatnot. And so I took about a 5-year break, just really not jumping and kind of reevaluating things and wanting to focus more on racing. And then, kind of early last year, it was just like, well, just not as happy as I used to be. And so I got back into it and my wife and I took a trip over to Europe this year for a vacation and, you know, sort of started doing a bunch of jumping again. And then, we've done some sort of jumps in the Southwest US here lately. And, it's the closest you can get to actual human flight. And now the suit technology is so good that you can actually, you know, go up for a little bit. You have to dive the suit for a while to gain enough speed to turn it, you know, into lift, but you know, you can actually go up in a wingsuit and, you know, kind of get to that stall point and get weightless and go down on the other side of the sort of the parabola. But yeah, it's totally amazing. And on a different side of things, skydiving, free flying, not wearing a wingsuit. I've been a part of, I think 5 different world records, with that over the years with, the biggest, vertical formation stuff, which is another, you know, really cool, challenging thing. You know, you're up there. I think the last one we did, I forget what the number ended up being, 162 people like linked up in a formation, but you know, you're around, you know, you've got 8 airplanes flying in formation and you're jumping out of them, you know, basically, you know, either looking down at airplanes that you're falling past or, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it sounds weird, but that's like the best stress reliever for me because there's so much politics and other stuff with racing and to just go out and do something, you know, for yourself that you enjoy, is really awesome. I'm definitely not a golf guy.
That's really cool. I had a chance, while I was at the academy to jump about 15 times. And I remember it went from kind of an activity of like overcoming your fear. And right, then towards the end, it just started to become towards something that it occupies all of your attention. So all of that, yeah, stress kind of goes away and you're kind of just in that zone.
Yep. Yeah. And it's the same thing for me. Like when I don't jump for a while, it's the trust of your gear and the trust of yourself kind of isn't there. And it's like, I've got a couple thousand skydives and if I don't jump for 6 months and I go back up, the first ones back into it are nerve wracking. And then you get comfortable and you know that, you know, your system itself is good. And then, you know, you can relax and to a certain extent and it becomes more fun. The base jumping thing, you know, for so many people just say, oh man, you're an adrenaline junkie. And it's like, not really, you know, I realize the risk. I accept the risk. And the absolute coolest thing with that, in my opinion, is if you are at the point where you can totally accept and be, you know, thankful and satisfied with your life and know that what you're doing could potentially end that. And that, you know, in that moment, you're, like you said, you're 100% occupied with what you're doing. And it's one of the most beautiful things that's out there, just, you know, flying your body along, you know, some gorgeous scenery. To be able to do that is something that's really, really special.
Is there any place where people can see you base jumping on video? I know on YouTube, I saw you driving Laguna Seca and you're talking through every turn, and that was really cool. So is there anywhere place to watch the base jumping?
Yeah. So I've got a Vimeo page. Early on, YouTube was kicking some of my videos off just because I had some music on there and I didn't really think that was super cool because I wasn't trying to make any money off of it. my Vimeo page, I forget what it is, Gunnar Jeanette or something. But if you search me on there, it's kind of a mixture of race cars and jumping stuff. So just a bunch of silly things that I've done over the years.
Cool. Any other place people can check you out at?
So Instagram, I tend to keep up with Instagram stuff pretty good, pretty well. That's just Gunnar Jeanette, G-U-N-N-A-R, and Jeanette's funky enough, but it should pop up. I kind of gotten off the Facebook bandwagon. And I definitely have a decent more amount of videos that I'm trying to get up, onto Vimeo. And I think I'm going to get my, my YouTube thing going again here, but yeah.
Awesome, Gunnar. Well, I really appreciate your time and you, taking the time to talk with me. So, I wish you the best and I hope, to get you back on the podcast at some point.
Yeah, I'd love to do it. I, likewise, I appreciate it. And, I'll definitely keep on listening.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Professionals Playbook. My name is Justin Lee. If you like what you heard, make sure to review it on iTunes, subscribe, and then share with a friend. Those three things will go a long way towards helping out the podcast. See you guys next time.